grandmother!
Alleged insanity.
Parasite sent to Sing Sing!
Tragedy. Mansfield Walworth killed by his own son.
Old family secrets have a way of resurfacing. Today in Saratoga Springs, New York, visitors to the Walworth Memorial Museum walk past a plaque bearing its dedication to the glory of God and the sanctity of the American home. Those who proceed up the grand staircase and climb to the third floor are in for a surprise.
I think it was rather tragic when you knew the veneer. But what went on behind closed doors?
My take was that it was almost like any large family, because you had the people here that were unhappy, like this lady in here, and then her eldest son killed the father. I mean, it's almost like any large family when you go back into the history of it.
What about the story itself? Was this something that you found either familiar in terms of contemporary domestic issues, or did you think that it was something that was really a matter that was squarely in the past?
I mean, you definitely get the impression that the Father Mansfield was not the nicest of characters, but at the same time, you don't fully understand why his son, I mean, you can imagine why his son was sort of caused to murder him, but perhaps
there's
more.
There's more.
There must be more story.
More.
The Walworth murder intrigued 19th century commentators as well. But no matter where people stood on the son Frank's guilt or innocence, everyone agreed that the murder told larger tales about the nature of public morals.
Walworth's sad fate preaches a sermon more powerful than anything that can be uttered from any pulpit, showing that there must be something radically wrong in society and in the mode and manner of living when the husband could persecute the wife for years with impunity and brutality, and an own child of his become the cold-blooded avenger. The Christian Union.
Parricide has always struck a sensitive chord. Legal and cultural historian Natalie Zeman Davis has written about the historic roots of family violence and its meanings.
There's a double story here, and that is a parallel between the attack on a figure of authority, a child on a parent, a wife against the husband, a parallel between that and attack of the subject against the sovereign. But let me add that there's a second dimension to this, and this is all the social and religious teaching about hierarchical authority. It isn't just a legal issue.
These ancient hierarchies were under assault in the mid-19th century as patriarchal family models faced new challenges. By the 1870s, masculine authority was quite evidently not what it had been.
By the 1870s, with the growing popularity of divorce, the growing acceptance of some kind of intervention on the part of the state in issues of child abuse, the recognition, the creation of private philanthropic organizations like the Children's Aid Society, all reflect a growing concern about parental responsibilities. And so the boundaries of the policing of the families are starting to come under increased scrutiny. In the post-Civil War period that lead to some, in this case, in the case of Woolworth, of raising those kinds of concerns about domestic abuse and finding a vehicle, a means by which to justify, in this case, a parricide, as possibly, if not necessarily acceptable form of behavior, at least an understandable response to domestic abuse.
Frank Walworth was the product of two illustrious families. His mother, born Ellen Hardin in 1832, was the daughter of an Illinois lawyer who was a close associate of Abraham Lincoln's. After her father died, Ellen's widowed mother married Reuben Walworth, a much older man with sterling, if stuffy, credentials.
The Walworths were a family that symbolized, in a way, a certain level of dignity and respectability and unquestionable moral authority. This had largely to do with the reputation of Frank's grandfather, Reuben Hyde Walworth. I mean, he was seen as this utterly good and gifted man who had given his many talents to the service of the Republic and to the service of the Presbyterian Church for a long career. He was involved in many, to him, worthy moral endeavors, and he had not been linked with scandal, so this was not a family that was a likely candidate to be involved in a scandalous murder.
Jeffrey O'Brien, author of The Fall of the House of Walworth, notes that trouble began as soon as stepsister Ellen married stepbrother Mansfield Walworth. The union also exposed the blended family's religious divisions. Reuben Walworth's first son, Clarence, had defied his father by converting to Catholicism and becoming a priest. Under his influence, the young couple converted as well, to the Chancellor's dismay. Mansfield and Ellen Walworth, young romantics in an age of romanticism, were impatient with their elder's displeasure. Newlywed Ellen wrote to her grandmother to reassure her that all would be well.
I have known that you disapproved of my marriage, and it has made me feel a kind of restraint about writing, which was foolish, I admit. But so it was, and I did not control the feeling. But now, dear Grandma, I am confident that however unwise you may have thought it for me to marry Mance, since it is done, you will not hesitate to give us your good wishes and prayers for our happiness. Though we will probably have many hardships and trials to encounter and endure, yet trusting in God and our own energy, we are courageous and hopeful without having any extravagant dreams of happiness and comfort in this world.
But the Hardin and Walworth families had further cause to worry. It was Mansfield's erratic and irresponsible behavior. He didn't lack brain power, just the discipline and restraint to apply himself to his legal studies. He fancied himself a literary genius, preferring the life of a footloose author to the tedium of civil litigation. But the New York Times took a dim view of his talents.
The genius of the man was marred and scarred by a bad nature. He was not taught to control himself. As a persistent idiot, Mr. Walworth was singularly successful.
Handsome and powerfully built, Mansfield Walworth had an animal quality about him. Sleek and charming one minute, enraged the next. His wife quickly realized that she had made a dreadful mistake. Only 2 years into their marriage, Ellen Walworth warned a confidant.
Married life has its own peculiar sorrows as well as joys. And they are sorrows that bring bitter tears and sharp heartaches too intense to be revealed to any but the unseen one who soothes them and lulls them to sleep in his own good time. But I do not mean to speak of these sad things now. Perhaps you will escape them, dearest. God grant you may.
Over the 1860s, the marriage deteriorated, as Mansfield's outbursts frequently turned violent. In 1871, supported by both branches of the family, Ellen Walworth filed for a divorce. Timothy Guilfoyle is professor of history at Loyola University.
Defenders of Walworth and defenders of his mother would have taken a more positive view about divorce. But on the other hand, many Americans, especially those that would have seen the case as representing some kind of breakdown of that familial ideal, that cult of true womanhood or the cult of domesticity that persisted throughout much of the 19th century. The fact that this event took place in a divorced household would have given credence to their belief.
Let no girl marry a sensual man to reclaim him. There are stains on such a soul that no love can wash away. From a woman's standpoint, I see that marriage, as an individual tie, is slavery for woman. Because law, religion, and public sentiment all combine under this idea to hold her true to this relation, whatever it may be. And there is no other human slavery that knows such depths of degradation as a wife chained to a man whom she neither loves nor respects.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the foremost suffragists in 19th century America, led the campaign to grant women the right to divorce men who inflicted mental or physical cruelty in marriage. Ellen Walworth never supported Stanton's cause, yet she did take advantage of New York State's divorce law. The Walworth divorce suit rested on two grounds: Mansfield's cruelty and his failure to support his family. Ellen Walworth's relatives, along with a family servant, corroborated her claims. One incident had occurred in 1870, after she'd berated Mansfield for refusing to seek steady employment.
He fell into a passion of rage and cursed and swore at me. He then struck and beat me with his closed fist and pushed me and dashed me forcibly upon the bed and used so much violence toward me that I became unconscious.
3 weeks later, another beating and more insults and threats.
My husband leaped upon me and cried out, "I will show you, damned Hardin, what I care for you," and spat several times in my face. And when I remonstrated with him and begged him to desist, he raised his clenched hand over my head and threatened my life, saying that "I will blow your damn brains out," until I screamed and by my cries brought the servants and other people in the house.
After the divorce, Mansfield contested the terms, and his threats persisted in letters he wrote to Ellen.
Ellen Hardin, the pistols are loaded. If you at any time succeed in getting from my control any part of the income of the trust estate created by my father, I shall shoot you dead in cold blood. Then stamp out your eyes with the heel of my boot, and then blow my brains out with the second barrel. Why? Because you have robbed me of my young. And now, in my intolerable agony at the loss of all that makes life tolerable, you remorselessly seek to knock from under the despairing wretch the last plank upon which he might live and succeed. You are dealing with an infuriated but determined demon devil, murderer, or whatever despair makes a man.
Meanwhile, unbeknownst to his mother, Frank Walworth had begun to intercept these letters. On June the 3rd, 1873, Frank met his father in a Manhattan hotel. After the shots were fired, Frank Walworth cabled his uncle, "Have shot father. Stop. Look after mother. Stop." Then he explained his motive.
"I am guilty of no crime. My father treated my mother very cruelly for years, incensed against his own father for putting his little share of property in trust so that my mother and family got something out of it. My father kept writing letters to my mother full of imprecations against his father. He wrote her, among other things, 'I will kill your boys and defeat the damn scoundrel in his grave and cut off his damn name forever.' He also threatened my mother's life about 3 years ago. He beat my mother cruelly. I was not present, but saw the marks. When I heard this, I loaded a pistol belonging to a cousin of mine and have carried it ever since. When my uncle recently proposed to take me on a trip to Europe, I was troubled about leaving Mother without protection.
So Frank displayed utter calm in the midst of what very quickly became an extremely chaotic scene, with people running all over the hotel, with the many guests. There was a Masonic convention in the hotel. So in the midst of all of this frenzy, Frank stood there utterly calm and seemingly casual. And this became the keynote of how the crime was then reported in the press. His coolness was seen as a kind of compounding of an already terrible crime.
The homicidal passion breaks out alike in high places and in low, and murderers and the murdered are found equally among the cultivated and the coarse. New York Tribune.
He maintains the same cool and almost cheerful demeanor that has characterized him since his entrance into the tombs.
We protest in advance against such resort to maudlin sentimentality, against this utter confusion of the moralities and of the good and bad motives which excite human action. New York Herald.
Jeffrey O'Brien.
I think it's very striking the way the New York press piles on Frank. I came to think of it as this kind of cynical chorus that kept chiming in to really mock, in a way, what the Walworths represented, the supposed honor and dignity of this old upstate family. It was really a kind of comeuppance, in a way, I think, from the point of view of some New Yorkers.
Cynical observers anticipated that the parricide, as the papers dubbed Frank Walworth, would be handled with kid gloves. Some reporters speculated that the defense might use one of the newly minted definitions of madness: emotional, temporary, or partial insanity. But this case, as it progressed over a few short weeks of a steamy New York summer, unfolded in ways that no one had predicted. Frank Walworth's lawyer, Charles O'Connor, was a towering figure at the New York bar. In pre-trial press interviews, he explained that he had taken the case without charge, since his client had acted honorably, if rashly. The same could not be said for the victim, Mansfield Walworth.
He was bad in grain, and his badness was the more contemptible because it was united to a character that was very frivolous and insane. In the course of the trial, facts will come out that will show how astonishingly bad this man was.
It was really pretty hard for Frank Walworth to make any kind of claim that his father whipped out a gun first and was about to shoot him. So it was, and he'd gotten a gun ahead of time. It was premeditated. So it seems to me that it was the discredited life of Mansfield Walworth that made it possible for this contradiction to be worked out and another story to be argued plausibly.
Without formally offering a defense of insanity, O'Connor suggested that the son might have inherited some form of mental weakness from his father, Jeffrey O'Brien.
It was very important to get the story out there about just how bad and mad Mansfield's behavior had been in order to get the public to accept the idea that Frank had in fact been justified in an act which otherwise was regarded with utter horror as the most unnatural of crimes.
Twelve New Yorkers would determine Frank Walworth's fate. Timothy Guilfoyle.
The juries, in most cases, would have been a whole range of different occupations, from glassmakers to butchers to the department store workers to clerks to factory workers. You would have had a whole range of different people. But the most common quality they would have shared would have been that they were all men.
All right.
Joseph H. Horton, jeweler. Jacob A. Chamberlain. James Provision Tucker. Machinist. Elijah Purdy.
Sashmaker.
George Wright, grocer.
Frank Walworth, in contrast, was a well-groomed youth, a student of law. Yet a pamphlet of the case, printed by a Philadelphia publisher, described the prisoner in dismissive terms.
The prisoner was neatly dressed in a suit of black broadcloth, the edges of a white vest being allowed just enough room near the lapels to set it off fashionably. There was just the least bit of bravado about his manner during the entire day. He seemed to be desirous of acting the part of a hero, knowing that he was the central figure in the proceedings and that all eyes were upon him. Still, his coolness and jaunty, don't-care-a-snap way of acting naturally led one to believe that instead of looking upon himself as a person whose life was in danger, he was sure of being lauded for what he had done.
The prosecution exploited the class gulf between the jurors and Frank Walworth. Surely a member of a family filled with lawyers and judges should have sought legal means to deal with the victim's behavior.
Hats off! Order! Order!
The assistant district attorney opened the trial. The people would argue that this was a case of clear and deliberate murder, the penalty for which was death.
There was the preparation. Going back even for 3 years previous, there was the absence of any provocation. There was the number of shots, which was inconsistent with any intention except the intention to kill. Every act and expression and admission of the prisoner showed overwhelmingly that the crime was premeditated murder.
State witnesses confirmed that Frank had traveled to Manhattan without luggage, just a Colt five-shooter tucked into his pocket. A string of hotel clerks, bellboys, maids, and police officers testified about the pandemonium that had erupted when the defendant had walked downstairs and announced,
"I have just shot my father."
Reporters reminded readers that parricide was the offense that had condemned Oedipus to misfortune, disgrace, and cruel tortures.
To conceive that the offspring should become the slayer of the parent is fearful under any circumstances. But when the offense is committed with intent and knowledge, its enormity is intensified a thousandfold. It was a crime punished by the ancients with awful rigor and held in deepest detestation. New York Daily Graphic.
Class and breeding had worked in Frank's favor as he had awaited trial. A single jail cell, free use of the corridors, extended visits with his family and his supporters. But his background also worked against him.
If education, refinement, culture, good blood, family pride, etc., are to be taken into account at all, when estimating the degree of moral guilt involved in the violation of the laws of God and man, they must be held to add to the moral responsibility of the criminal who was blessed with such advantages. Otherwise, the community will be in greater danger from those who are regarded as its brightest ornaments than from the outlaws and outcasts of society. Albany Weekly Times.
The defense counterattacked. It was Mansfield Walworth who had been the outlaw and outcast. Consequently, his son was neither morally nor legally responsible for the shooting. Toward the end of his life, Mansfield Walworth's novels had brought him a degree of notoriety, but little respect. The New York Times had judged that his work was
only intended for and bought by the numerous classes of persons who admire glittering and gaudy description and sentimental storytelling.
No one outside the family circle realized that the fever-brained author had penned far more disturbing letters to his wife. They came by the dozen, as many as five a day.
God damn you. You have had no thought for me for the past 3 years but to beggar me and grasp my inheritance. False, foul, cold, demon-hearted bitch.
The pistols for you and I are lying beside me loaded all the time.
I am hungry and longing to lap my tongue in salt blood.
You are making your grave by this delay.
Oh, we shall lie side by side, so peaceful in death. Sweet death. Sweet death.
For years, Ellen Walworth gave none of her troubles away. But now, as her son faced the death penalty, she knew she would have to testify to the horrors that had taken place behind doors. Clad in her mourning dress and wearing a veil, she braced herself as her dead husband's profane words were read out in court.
Prepare yourself for the inevitable. I am getting over my wasting fever, and I am going to call upon my children. My heart is starving for their caresses. I will see them, peaceably if I can, or with a tragedy if I must. Their little faces haunt me as they are mine. Keep Frank Walworth out of my way. You have taught him to hate me, and his presence or obstruction in any way will only excite fatal exasperation. Beware that you do not in any way arouse the frenzy which you have known to exist since you left me. I shall shoot you and myself on these doorsteps, for I have nothing further to live for. I am a broken-hearted desperado. Oh, you wretch that kept me 2 years from the little hands and hearts that love me. All is lost, and a tragedy must come. Two pistol shots will ring out about the house, one slaying you, the other myself. The God of justice demands it.
The defense used these letters to build a case of the victim's insanity. Lawyer Charles O'Connor told the jury that Mansfield Walworth's letters
could hardly have proceeded from any but an insane mind.
For 3 hours on a sweltering afternoon, as Charles O'Connor read Mansfield's letters into evidence, every heart was stilled with horror.
Beware of me. God damn you. I am dangerous. I am watching you with a hawk's eye and a despairing heart. The pistol is lying beside me low. When stripped by you of my property, plunge my dagger into Frank's heart and cut off the Walworth name forever. You have robbed me of love, of children, of pride. Now you aim to rob me of hope. By Jesus, I'll never give it up. I'll hush your goddamn woman's rights pretenses with a bullet. And like a flaming demon, I will scatter your brains. Do you hear? Do you hear?
The very fact that the New York Times felt obliged to run an editorial about Mansfield's letters, and even while saying we don't mean to comment on the outcome of the trial, but we do feel obliged to say that the entire community is offended by these letters, even though the guy who wrote them was dead and it, and justice of whatever kind had already been done to him. So the idea that he had to be denounced anyway is really quite striking.
The defense argued that Frank Walworth's knowledge of these threats had played on his mind. Witnesses testified that he would turn pale and rigid, often appearing insensible. More significantly, the young man also suffered from epilepsy. In the 19th century, epilepsy was associated with insanity and criminality. Professor Charles Rosenberg of Harvard University.
It got described under the umbrella of degeneration theory, the notion that these call them neuropathic conditions, were not that specific, that could be transferred from generation to generation. and what might appear as alcoholism in one generation could be major depression or delusional insanity in the next generation, or mental retardation. And a lot of people did feel that epilepsy was somehow a both physical and hereditary in some dimension. So that this would not have been an, you call it off the wall, out of the box, implausible kind of association to contemporaries. Though lawyers, of course, especially prosecution lawyers, were not happy with it because of its exculpatory implications.
The defense presented no evidence of emotional or partial insanity, as had been the case in recent notorious murder trials. Instead, lawyer Charles O'Connor linked evidence of Frank's epilepsy and reports of his emotional enfeeblement to the argument that he had acted chivalrously. Historian Natalie Davis.
I was fascinated by the Walworth case, even a bit shocked by the story. And it seemed to me, therefore, very important, a case that really speaks to a lot of issues. It's feelings and concerns in 19th century America. The use of contradictory arguments, that is, on the one hand, that really he was incompetent and he was too fragile, on the one hand, he wasn't healthy, on the other hand, but he did the right thing by defending his mother against this dangerous husband of hers, ex-husband of hers, and his father. That use of arguments seems to me the way the law often works.
But the grocers and sash makers who judged Frank Walworth found the defendant guilty of murder in the second degree. Frank Walworth escaped the hangman, but he received a life sentence to be served at Sing Sing State Penitentiary. Once the trial was over, new claims could be made on Frank's behalf. Ellen Walworth requested that prison doctors examine her son, whose physical and mental condition broke down soon after he entered the penitentiary. In December 1873, Frank Walworth was transferred to the Auburn Asylum for the Criminally Insane in upstate New York.
Probably the most telling statistic about the Auburn Hospital is the high rates of suicide and the high rates of death. Generally, the Auburn Hospital would have had a death rate that was three or four times higher than the general population, which in itself seems to point to a certain amount of maltreatment of the inmates during their incarceration at the hospital.
So when we're talking about asylum, then we're not talking about some lovely grounds and walking around in fresh air.
No, I think it would be fair to describe Auburn as a warehousing of some sort of the insane, of the those that were deemed criminally insane. So the supervisory staff really knows very little about the conditions of insanity, which I think further contributes to the poor treatment of many of the insane inmates.
Ellen Walworth repeatedly urged politicians and prison administrators to transfer her son to a proper hospital, or better still, to send him home to recover. But she was not the sort of woman to parade her suffering. Nor did faith provide solace anymore, as she wrote in her private journal.
When the struggle, the tussle, the agony of real life came, I found that the common sense and the common practice of those who were engaged in that turmoil was the only groundwork upon which its problems could be met and solved. Not religion, but honor. Not sentiment, but sense. Not spiritual guidance, but human sympathy or lonely courage were the only areas with which this warfare was to be waged.
With her son in prison, Ellen went to battle with pen and paper in her public campaign for clemency.
For what to me is this world if I must remain in it and be pointed at as the mother of a felon convict? My name, my paternity, preclude retreat from observation. unless by retiring to a dungeon.
In 1877, after a four-year campaign to release Frank Walworth, the governor finally relented.
My own conviction is that the life Frank Walworth had led and the sufferings he had borne added to the constitutional weakness of his mind, and so far worked upon him that he was not accountable for his act. He is therefore not a proper subject for criminal punishment, and was not such at the time of his conviction. The present mental condition of the prisoner, while it furnishes no ground for his pardon, yet it renders the question of his further detention simply one of public morals. The only question left is whether the interests of society yet demand detention of an epileptic in the asylum for insane convicts. To detain him in confinement would degrade the administration of justice to the level of a mere engine of vengeance, and ill befits the dignity of the laws of civilization or humanity which belong to this age. Governor Lucius Robinson, August 2nd, 1877.
Several newspapers attributed the pardon to the Walworth family's status and to the machinations of a very artful woman. But most simply published the pardon without comment. In 1877, the U.S. was in the midst of a severe depression that had led to labor unrest. New worries, new headlines. For Frank Walworth, life began afresh. He married his childhood sweetheart, the daughter of a former governor of Kentucky, and the couple had a baby girl. But his mother worried that he lacked ambition.
A great anxiety oppresses me. It is Frank's profession to be a failure. Oh, I have feared this, but I have not dared contemplate it until this time. His health, his mind, his future are all at stake. Oh, I shudder to think about it. Ah, me, how I watched and waited and tried to help onward another life. The end, what will it be? I look in all directions and try to see a path.
Frank Walworth's path ended abruptly in 1886, when he died at the age of 34 of a pulmonary disease. His medical treatment at Auburn may well have contributed to his premature death, since sodium bromide, a chemical compound doctors used to treat epilepsy in the mid-19th century, was known to cause lung damage. Ellen Walworth buried her son when she was 54 years old. Jeffrey O'Brien.
Well, Ellen, I think, at a certain moment, felt that she had never actually lived because her life had been utterly caught up, first of all, in the lives of her parents, and then her marriage to Mansfield, which was a nightmare, culminating in violent death, and then Frank's act and everything that followed on that. So it was only when she got beyond all of that that she began to feel as if she was actually living for the first time. In Chicago in 1879, she writes in her journal, "Oh, for freedom, freedom." But I do think she really was a tremendously frustrated person who really wanted to create a completely different life, a completely different self out of the wreckage of what her life had been.
Ellen Walworth's crowning achievement came in 1890 when she co-founded the Daughters of the American Revolution, a national women's patriotic organization. Almost 20 years earlier, reporters had scrutinized the fold of her widow's veil and the tone of her voice at her son's murder trial. Now, the press published the speeches she delivered to the Republic's finest citizens.
Women in homes simple, beautiful, or luxurious,
should realize that their parlors and their tables are thrones from which, by means of the golden words that fall from their lips, shall emanate the radiance of their virtues, the influence of their intellectual gifts, and the graciousness of their charity. To reign worthily on such a throne is the legitimate ambition of every American woman. The power exercised with tact and delicacy in the family extends to public opinion. And thus the low-toned voice of a frail woman may shake or uphold the mighty fabric of the state.
Against all odds, the divorcee and mother of a convicted murderer had reinvented herself. Jeffrey O'Brien.
I think by then she had succeeded in burying that story for a lot of people. And you know, it's notable that by the time she died, the obituaries made little or no reference to that. She had succeeded in making a life that was more important than that story, or at least she had earned enough respect that people weren't going to drag that in.
There's much in this tale of parricide that locates it squarely in the 19th century, but there's a great deal to this domestic homicide that's familiar, as violence within the family, even in the most respectable circles, continues to confound legal and political reforms.
This kind of crime happens all the time, as I've become more aware than ever, since while I was working on the book, I would pick up the paper, and it seemed like every other day there was a story about a jealous or deranged husband killing or threatening to kill his estranged wife or children. So from that point of view, it's not at all an exotic story.
Murder is still closer to home than we care to admit, no matter how much we like to think of the family as a haven. Let's return to the Walworth Museum in Saratoga Springs, New York.
The whole museum I found a lot more relatable than most museums I go to.
It was very personal. I loved
and
it.
And I love really how the museum really shows that even though, you know, it was set way back then, we always picture the perfect family, and it was still had the dysfunctional, the religious disputes, murder, which surprised me.
Yeah, this museum puts out like a lot of things in the open that most museums would leave out. A lot of real issues that, you know, happened back then. So you get to see like how that relates, how the past relates to, you know, now.